Monday through Friday. Thank you very much. Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time, as I continue to launch this program into the stratosphere. I am doing this live program every weeknight where I take calls, where I invite guests. Let's see, let me just call up my Skype so we can get the calls going here. And, you know, it's kind of like an informal, but yet I think pretty deep conversation with an interesting and variety and cross-section of people that I'm in the process of getting up online. If you'd like to join the conversation, 617-396-4958. 617-396-4958. And of course, the flagship station is Rumble, and you're welcome to join the Rumble chat room, I suppose you might say, at rumble.com, Charles Moskowitz at rumble.com. Dovid should be here shortly. I also am going to be having Pastor Bill Jenkins on with me in the second hour today. Pastor Jenkins is the author of the Prophetic Almanac for 2022. So we're kind of talking about things from a religious perspective, which is usually what I like to do on Thursday night. Tomorrow, by the way, at 11, I'm going to be very happy to welcome William T. Still, Bill Still, the Still Report. I've been following Bill Still for a long time. He's an insider Washington, D.C. reporter who has a lot of connections in the Beltway. He's been around for a while. I think he's been doing this since the 1970s. He had a tremendous run on YouTube leading up to the 2020 election and shortly following the election throughout the controversy of the election steal period, which was between November 3rd and Inauguration Day. And then I believe he was taken off of YouTube like so many other people, or he just does kind of a more benign program there. So I'm looking forward to having him here on the Uncensored station, that being mine, Charles Moskowitz Live, where I can catch up and find out what he has going on. There's a lot of developments in Washington right now. I'm waiting for Dovid. Dovid, where are you, Dovid? I want to get into it with Dovid once he's here, but I might as well forge forward while I wait for Dovid. I think that there's a lot of significance to the juxtaposition between the letter that was sent by the National Association of School Boards, whoever they are, some kind of a shadowy group, and the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, basically claiming that the parents, the citizens at school board meetings around the country, people who were criticizing critical race theory and the pandemic, were domestic terrorists. And that this juxtaposes with Vice President Harris's comments on the anniversary of the insurrection, or what Howie Carr calls the Fedsurrection, and where she compared that to Pearl Harbor and the events of 9/11. I heard Jack Prosobiec have a very interesting insight on that, where he pointed out that this juxtaposition and this comparison basically is a declaration of war against so-called domestic terrorists, which is really anyone who supports President Trump. That could be upwards of 75 plus million people. By comparing that event, the incursion into the U.S. Capitol, to Pearl Harbor, which of course resulted in World War II, and 9/11, which was, of course, a terrorist incident that resulted in the war against international terrorism. Now it's going to be possibly a war against Americans by making that comparison. Dovid, how are you?
Hey, great. Sorry, my computer had some sort of slowdown there.
Okay. Well, you know, what I'm saying here, Dovid, is that I think there's a juxtaposition between Vice President Harris making that speech on the anniversary of the incursion into the Capitol, which, by the way, that whole narrative is unraveling now, is now that we're finding out that the various federal agencies were all over that, basically comparing that to Pearl Harbor and the events of 9/11, using which, of course, were acts of war and domestic and acts of terrorism, and referring to that as an incident that involved domestic terrorists. And this shadowy group called the National School Board Association sending Attorney General Merrick Garland a letter with the content of which has been published, basically claiming that they're concerned that parents criticizing various things at school board meetings were domestic terrorists, and that the FBI should investigate them. These are incredible developments. I mean, I think that this is possibly a war against Americans, all of us, mainly me and other Trump supporters, not necessarily you. The 75 million people who voted for Trump. And, it's now come out that the secretary, I think it was the secretary of not agriculture, but a high level secretary, cabinet position member, Cordona, I think his name is. He had initiated this letter that this school board group sent to the attorney general, which means that there's a collusion going on here. This is an inside job. And when I say collusion, I'm talking about the type of collusion that would make anything that Donald Trump was accused of with Russia look like nothing. I mean, like patty cakes compared. I mean, this was an attempt to set up a situation by which American citizens, using their First Amendment right to speak up at school board meetings, could face domestic terrorism charges. And all of this in this heightened atmosphere of claiming that white supremacy is on the rise and that the January 6th incursion was done by white supremacists, which there's no evidence at all of that. And, these are very, very serious times in terms of freedom. I think it's going to get worse. I think it's going to ramp up as we get closer to the midterm election, because the Democratic Party knows that they're going to be completely wiped out. The Republicans are going to not only take back both the House and the Senate, but probably at an unprecedented and historic margin, which could really kick the Democratic Party back a generation. So there's going to be more histrionics, more hysteria, more very dangerous events that I think are going to unfold between now and that election, which is really only 9 months away. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's why I said last, it's kind of just fake war stories that I don't think anyone buys. I mean, as a virtue signal to the donors, maybe specifically most to Silicon Valley, who might have the power to, God forbid, rig, help them out with elections, the voter fraud, the voting rights, too little too late. I mean, no one's buying it in the constituency. I think the approval ratings tanking, COVID-19, the Omicron, inflation, basically everything's going wrong. Even, the filibuster, people wanted them to do the filibuster rule to pass the mass spending budget. Maybe that there was probably more interest in it to pass like the progressive Bernie Sanders type spending package than there is for the voting rights. So, I mean, it might be enough to create some sort of, God forbid, like disinformation, false illusion campaign, fraud for them to you know, they probably want to do some sort of Bush, you know, post 9/11 Homeland Security type packet, which there's no way they're going to pass that.
Right.
So it's more, right. It's more a virtue signal probably to social media companies to, for them to, you know, get more draconian. And, you know, I agree with your sentiment. It's largely failing. And, you know, 2022 will probably be, I don't know how disastrous, because, you know, the demographics favor the Democratic Party, but yeah, I mean, they'll probably lose the Senate and the House, which, it probably also be disastrous for America. I'm not too optimistic that, I mean, even if you're right, that, you know, that the right winning big is going to accomplish much, because I don't think they're going to be able to legislate. And at this point, you'll probably, we're going to need a extended period of austerity. And so maybe, you know, like a Republican House and Senate and Biden as president will, you know, be the state where we have this, you know, God forbid, extended austerity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that the ability to govern is going to depend on the margin of victory for both the Senate and the House. And I think that margin is going to be considerable. I mean, I've heard estimates of up to 80 seats in the House are going to go Republican. And we see every day Democrats are announcing they're not running again, they're retiring. And it just,
it's not going to really be unity. Like, there's not really going to be like a governing mandate unity, even if the Republicans win extremely big. Like, what are they going to do with it? And, you know, what's their mandate? What type of legislation? And you know, saying the country, God forbid, will probably necessitate austerities. So, you know, it could be, I don't know what you think. What you think they're going to do with that majority?
I think there will be a mandate, only because with that kind of majority, and with Biden really having no political capital at this point. I mean, the recent Quinnipiac poll shows that he is only 30% approval. I mean, that's worse than Nixon had as he walked to the helicopter on the day he resigned. I mean, this is the worst approval rating this early in a presidency, probably since James Buchanan. You know, this is really to the point where when he went down to Atlanta and gave that ridiculous, insulting speech comparing anybody who doesn't support a filibuster to Jefferson Davis, and, you know, you noticed that Stacey Abrams was not on stage with him. She was nowhere to be found. She doesn't want to go anywhere near Biden because she's running for governor in Georgia. And she knows that she has to kind of move to the center a little bit and gain some independent votes, where Biden is down, apparently down to like 2%. And she even has to get some Republicans on board in order to win. So she's nobody. He's like, you know, he's like almost politically dead. I mean, he's gone. And Harris is even worse. And I think that all of these things create a very dangerous time, because there could be some desperate measures taken between now and then to try to, somehow steal the election. You know, there could be another big virus coming down the pike so they can paper the House with millions of ballots, which is what they did last time. Maybe there could be, God forbid, some kind of a terrorist incident, which they'll blame on the Trump supporters. When you see a vice president talk about domestic terrorists having to do with the Capitol incursion, which is ridiculous, and then that juxtaposed with the attorney general asking the FBI to investigate parents who criticize critical race theory and the masking and a few other things, sex education in schools using their free speech, as domestic terrorists. Yeah, this is like, these are things that are done by very, you know, strong-armed authoritarian type governments that are truly trying to cling to power. And, I just think we're entering into a very, very dangerous couple of months. And I think you're absolutely right about the big tech trying to censor. I mean, at this point, they're pulling everything down. I mean, Twitter is going way out there. I mean, I don't really, if they're going to take down Sebastian Gorka, who was an advisor to President Trump, and Steve Bannon. I mean, these people are Republican thinkers and philosophers. I mean, they even took down Eric Metaxas, who's a pretty mainstream conservative and who's the author of a book about Martin Luther, best New York bestselling book. He had a very, very slick, very stylish YouTube program where he had producers and lighting and music and guests coming into a fancy studio. They've completely taken him down. And so, this is like, I'm grateful to be on Rumble and to doing the program I'm doing, and I don't have to worry about it anymore. So I feel like I'm liberated from fear on that count. At least Rumble so far is so good. I've also putting stuff up on Odyssey, by the way.
And I just watched Jonathan Greenblatt's, the Commonwealth Club in California.
Yeah.
If you've heard of it, it was a few weeks ago, but they just published it a few days ago, his speech on his new book. And he had mentioned that, the ADL had defended the Nazis' march in Skokie and that there's still free speech, but, platforms and incitement to violence. And he said, let them go to Rumble. I thought maybe they're going to come after on Rumble also.
They probably are going to come after him.
I was kind of surprised that he was like, let him go to Rumble. And he specifically said Rumble.
Yeah, and they are going to Rumble. In fact, you had Joe Rogan.
I mean, he said he wasn't going to come after Rumble. And that kind
oh,
of
he's not.
He was defending free speech to a certain level. And he just said
and he thinks Rumble is some fringe station, right? That it's
So that's why he said, let him go to some fringe place like Rumble.
Well, it shows that he doesn't know what's going on, because Rumble, recently Joe Rogan, who is the biggest podcaster in the country, interviewed Dr. Robert Malone, who is one of the inventors of the vaccine and who's one of the nation's most respected immunologists and doctors. And Twitter banned it. And he signed the so-called Barrington Agreement with many dozens of other respected doctors, basically saying that they believe that the vaccine should only be administered to people who actually really need it, because they're in a danger group, like they're at a certain age or they have pre-existing conditions, and that we should be making ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine available to everyone else because it works in terms of treating the virus. For that, he was banned from Twitter. So Joe Rogan said, okay, well, F you. And he opened up an account on Getter, which, by the way, I have an account on Getter, and I urge people to sign up there. And apparently, a million people followed him to Getter. So, I mean, that was a real blunder, I think, on the part of Twitter. And that same thing with Rumble. Everyone is jumping onto Rumble now. Even here in Boston.
I won't take him at his word. They'll come after Rumble also.
Yeah, but the thing is that for now, Howie Carr, who is on WRKO in Boston, the largest radio station in New England for talk, a legacy station, he was getting strikes on YouTube. So he's gone to Rumble and his show is growing rapidly. Now, yeah, you might be right, Dovid. They might go after Rumble. For now, Rumble is a great refuge. It's sort of like a lifeboat. But my strategy and my own little show is to have all of these platforms. If you go to my website, charlesmoskowitz.com, you're going to see 10 live stream sites and about 30 other sites where I post the show. So I feel like if one of them goes down, then I'll jump onto the other. If Rumble goes down, I'll go to Odyssey. If Odyssey goes down, I'm live on DLive. If
DLive goes down, you get views on all of them. Odyssey just up, in the single digits, and Rumble in the tens, and hopefully, it's old school networking. And I guess Greenblatt's latest book that he's talking about, he wants to sue people for the algorithm and amplification, and probably Google and the various companies are scared of it. And so that you're not going to get much help from the algorithm in terms of that legally you might be able to be held liable if the algorithm starts referring videos to people and then they go after, these days for almost anything. So old-fashioned networking, your word of mouth, spread the word.
But that's
the algorithm, if they could sue companies for the algorithm and say your algorithm referred this video to them, and therefore you're liable.
Oh, I'm liable? No, I don't think so.
I mean, you were saying that the company, that's what Greenblatt was saying he wants to do. He wants to sue the tech companies that use algorithms and say if the algorithm recommends videos, that the tech company could be sued and responsible. So it could be that the algorithms aren't going to help you. It's just going to be old-fashioned networking.
Well, that's right. And the show is growing. And I have every, because through Podomatic, which is my subscription, it's the one site that I pay for. I'm live on Podomatic right now, by the way. Podomatic automatically sends my audio podcast, not the video, but the audio, to at least a half a dozen sites, including iTunes and including iHeartRadio and Spotify, which are all major sites. And they have a fantastic statistical page that I look at every morning to see, you know, how many downloads, how many visits. Now they've had graphics up there. They've got a pie chart. And my show is picking up steam at, of all places, iTunes, the Apple podcast. For some reason, I am getting traction on iTunes. And I'm also getting traction on this rather obscure audio called Ghana. And it's connected to the nation of Ghana in Africa. Apparently, I have some following there, and it's growing. I mean, I don't know what it is that I did.
God works in mysterious ways. You know, Ashkaka Pratis, divine providence. You never know how it's going to work. You just focus on giving good product, doing good research, speaking to interesting people.
Right. I'm being consistent. I'm doing the program at the same time every night. I've got interesting.
I'm taking another course on public speaking right now. I'm always listening to that.
Yeah.
You know, stuff. There's always stuff you can improve your game.
Well, I listen. The way I try to improve myself is that now that I work out every morning, I go to a gym, the JCC actually, and I lift weights and I'm getting healthier. I listen at the same time to my own podcast and I critique it and I'm learning and I try to think about what I'm doing that's not good and good. And, you know, and
God forbid the JCCs in Metro Detroit shut down. There were two of them and just financial difficulties. They both of them have shut down now.
Oh, that's too bad. So, yeah, but I'm definitely, I have, by the way, Tom Jump is coming on with, or I'm going on his show.
Oh, great. Good for you.
Yeah, because I saw you on him and I've been following him. He's a pretty good debater. He's pretty tough.
He reached out. Yeah, I think he charged you $50, but maybe you saw that.
No, he's not charging me.
You're a professional, so he cut you in for free.
He cut me in.
That's how he makes money. So like, I'm saying not saying he doesn't make exceptions. He made an exception for me, but people paying $50 to get on his show like that.
Well, I mean, he's invited. I mean, I reached out to him, but he responded by saying, "Come on at this. I think it's going to be first week of February."
Oh, yeah, glad to hear that.
Yeah, and I think
he went over guys like he probably looked at your channel, so you had some big names like you had Stephen Mayer, and
that's right.
Like he's one of the definitely top five, maybe even the top single E atheist out there.
Yeah,
so good for you.
Yeah, I watched his interview with Jay Dyer, which was really, I mean, Jay was like they were like practically screaming at each other, which is not really my style. I don't want to do that if I can avoid it.
It was pretty cordial. I mean, so his comment section was pretty vicious, but I mean, not like vicious, but just kind of belittling and unfriendly. Like,
I understand.
I didn't have any counter-Semitism there at all. It was just kind of like, you lie, you lie because you think that you're using logic, but you're really not using logic.
Oh, is that what you got?
Well, I mean, that was kind of like the meanness, like you're dishonest and lying in like an intellectual kind of way, which, so relatively like, and he's, definitely professional. So quite a few things, small things in Israel I wanted to bring up.
Sure. What's going on?
Just before I tuned in, E. Michael Jones had this big debate on Modern Day Debate where T-Junk was like the house atheist. Mm-hmm. Where he debated regularly. And he was debating Vaush, who was probably one of the bigger e-debaters out there, and had over 1,000 live viewers on pornography, God forbid. But the Modern Day Debate, which is probably the biggest regular internet debate platform out there. I mean, there might be like I Squared or.
And you had E. Michael Jones debating Tom Jubb?
No, he debated Vaush. I'm not sure if you heard of Vaush.
And now E. Michael Jones.
But, I mean, Tom Jumps is a regular on modern day debate.
Yeah.
So they get, you know, they've been doing pretty good. They raise money, probably makes like a few hundred dollars a show. He's able to crowdsource money to pay guests. And so he's leveraged that money. This guy, James, who runs the channel, to make a symposium called DebateCon in Texas tomorrow and not tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday. So IRL, their main panelists, including T-Jump and Destiny, another big internet name in the debate circles, also gaming, are going to be debating a whole bunch of issues for like a two-day in-person conference. So I think it's going to lose. He thinks he's going to actually lose quite a bit of money that, you know, is premature, even though they get thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of views, makes a few hundred dollars a show, that still, it was preemptive to make an IRL event, you know, like where are you going to make it from internet, but he chose Texas, but they're doing it. And, you know, so Tom Jump is doing like four debates in 2 days and, you know, we'll see how many people, you know, come up, but I think, you know, it's a good thing. And, you know, unfortunately, he's probably going to lose money, but I'm glad he, you know, went forward and is trying that. So E. Michael Jones was on tonight with Vaush, who's a younger person. I think he took some sort of like high birth in Hollywood. And it's why he's non-Jewish, but he's kind of like pro pornography and communism, and he's homosexual, and he's pro Antifa. He admits to doxing people. In various things, but he
Michael Jones probably had no problem taking him on.
Well, I mean, they both have their audience, so I mean, he didn't like E. Michael Jones was pretty good, and this guy's in his late 20s, but I mean, he was pretty smart. So it was you know like it's one of the type things where they're most of the people are in one corner or the other and tend to think that their guy won,
right?
You know, so it was interesting. This guy Vaush, you know. Called him out for his anti-Semitism and
even
mentioned the Jewish role in pornography a little bit, but the Judaism didn't really come up. And E. Michael Jones was mentioning classical, you know, just arguments.
He's like he's writing a book right now about beauty and in art. And I actually, I asked.
I was asking what you did, but you said you were going
to. Yeah, I asked him if he wanted to come on with me, and he sent me back a note saying that he's not feeling well and that he's sick. But that maybe contact him in a while. So I didn't know what was going on.
Well, you just had a big debate. There was over 1,000 live viewers.
Okay.
You know, so maybe he did. Maybe he wasn't feeling well, and he just didn't want to, you know, miss this opportunity for a huge.
Whatever. I'll call.
Maybe he feels better. But I thought I mentioned that.
You know, oh, thank you.
I was curious if you talked to him or what your type of strategy. You were going to use,
and
super chat asked him about anti-Semitism. He mentioned a few interesting points. E. Michael Jones said, like, you know, he denounced anti-Semitism, and he just said that they falsely label that because you're not allowed to critique you know, Judaism or Jewish power. But and I could see in a certain way, you know, he's actually kind of philo-Semitic, but I mean, he claimed that he's not anti-Semitic, and he also claimed that. You know, one of the downfalls of pornography was actually censorship. That people favor pornography is like freedom, anti-censorship. But he said that you know, really it's worked out the opposite, is that they allowed pornography and then they ended up censoring all the things that shouldn't have been censored.
Right.
And yeah, I'm not sure if he's like calling for censorship.
Well, it becomes an oversweep of censorship when there are certain things.
I'm saying the allowance of pornography caused that he had some sort of argument that the allowance of pornography has caused censorship of speech, and they don't go hand in hand. That's like, oh, you should have free speech, you should have free
it's sort of the entrance into censorship, because you're censoring something that's not good and that's odious as a way to kind of get into the
pornography, not the censorship, because I mean that he said the allowance of pornography has led to the censorship of speech. That was one of arguments. It was kind of like a
right, and also
counterintuitive.
E. Michael Jones
now he's saying like everything that should be allowed is forbidden and everything that should be forbidden is allowed.
Yeah, I've heard him make that argument, and I actually think he does a very good job of that. And he does not consider himself to be an anti-Semite because he claims, and I think this was the traditional Catholic view before World War II, which is that anti-Semitism was coined by this Enlightenment figure, Wilhelm Marr, in the late 19th century, based on race, and that, you know, that it was the Jewish people were a race, and that to be against them was to be against them, their race. And it was also echoed in a way by a Jewish thinker by the name of Moses Hess, who was a friend of Karl Marx, and who was the author of I think from, what was it, from Beirut to Jerusalem, or, you know, it's like an early
Thomas Friedman. But I think he
honestly, that's Thomas Friedman's book, but it was a book like that. He's an early.
I think he honestly likes Jews. I mean, he has his opinions that, you know, I saw this week that we talked last week about Rashida Tlaib. So actually a woman on the board of directors of the Reform Synagogue, I had my bar mitzvah, came out in defense of Rashida Tlaib. And I'm going to imagine that you're going to have some liberal voices that are going to keep on coming out in favor of her, especially that she's likely to win.
But the thing is
that already happened this week but Michael Jones probably honestly likes Jews. He has beliefs and opinions that
he doesn't have anything against
anti-Semitic, but I think he honestly enjoys
the point is he
Jewish company and speaking to Jews. It just his opinions and beliefs are what most Jews would consider anti-Semitic, but he himself...
He differentiates himself. And as I said, it's a pre-World War II Catholic view and largely a Christian view, which is...
Like that, Henry Ford style. He didn't mind dealing with Jews as individuals and even valued his friends with individual Jews.
But he felt there was a conspiracy. But the thing is that he believes that Jews, because Jews are responsible, allegedly, for killing Christ, that we're somehow cursed and that we're subversive and we're trying to overthrow the order, or what he calls the logos, of the universe because we killed God, and that this has been a traditional Christian view. Now the way, and now that I see that his magazine is starting to run articles that almost kind of lean in the direction of Holocaust denial, my strategy is going to be to simply say that you know, in the same way that he likes to quote the story of Joseph and the how he was thrown into the pit by his brothers and they try to kill him, and then one of the brothers let him live, and then he ends up going on to become basically the prime minister of Egypt, and then the brothers are coming down there and they're starving, and when he reveals himself to them and says, you know, that they're completely expecting him to have them executed, and they're horrified. And he says, well, you see, the thing is that out of this evil that you did to me came good. You know, there was a purpose. There's a message that in the broader sense, God had a reason for this, and that out of this came something good. And my point to him is going to be that out of the evil of the Holocaust, which was largely from the people, the responsibility for the Holocaust rests with Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. But the Catholic Church and some other Christian churches, by continuing this traditional view that the Jews were Christ killers and that we are somehow cursed, it contributed to it. It contributed to the atmosphere that made it possible. And it also contributed to Catholic nations like in Latin America, slamming the door on Jews trying to get out of Germany because they didn't want to welcome in a group that they viewed as cursed. And that one of the good things, if anything, that came out of the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust, besides the one obvious good thing, which was the establishment of the State of Israel, is the fact that the Catholic Church changed and Christianity changed. And that was a change that Michael Jones views as part of a Jewish conspiracy. I mean, if you've read his book, the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, he kind of leans in that way. I would say that it came because Christians developed a conscience and they realized that they had to change that view because it did contribute to this immoral action, and that it was out of a sense, it was almost out of a divine sense that they had to make this right. And so they rejected that view of the Jews as killing Christ, that that was a mistake to have that so literally into the New Testament. It was put there by people who were anti-Jewish, and that they had to view Jews as the brothers. And the culmination of this movement came about when Pope John Paul II went to a synagogue in Rome, and he said as much. He said, the Jews are our spiritual brothers. You might even say they're our elder brothers. And that, you know, we have to condemn the condemnation of the Jews very completely. We have to reject that. And all of that kind of business around, you know, the responsibility for killing Christ, which is insane, that Jews today would be seen as cursed because of that alleged, even if that was true, which it was not. But, you know, it's just to blame, you know, the entire Jewish people. I mean, that's, it's not rational. It's not really proper from a religious standpoint. And so I think that Christianity generally and Catholicism particularly rejected that, and that's a miracle, and that's good. So that's a good, and that's what I'm going to say to Michael Jones.
Well, yeah, let me tune into that definitely. So you want to hear a few interesting things in Israel this week?
Sure.
Okay, so I'll run down quickly and then we could talk about them. There was some violence and riots with the Bedouins related to actually the JNF, the Jewish National Fund's tree planting campaign, which at this point, like, it's almost symbolic, but basically they were planting trees in an area in the Negev that I guess is largely inhabited by Israeli Arab Bedouins.
Yes.
And they protested and they rioted and there was violence. Yeah. And eventually they stopped the tree planting campaign. And so most Israelis agree that like the trees don't help any, like from an ecological point of view. I mean, something in America, I remember as a kid, like, you know, the campaign, like, you know, you plant a tree for Kibbutz Shvat coming up, but I was saying that the tree planting is somewhat of a precursor to a land grab. And so they didn't want these tree planting because if they're going to plant trees there, you know, next thing you know, they're going to take their land away. And so there was quite a few days of riots and violence, and eventually they backed off. And so they're not planting trees now in the
at all.
In the Negev region.
I mean, completely banned all of them. I mean, is it like a total, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, I understand that the Bedouins are generally not anti-Israel. They're not, it's not like the, some of the Palestinians on in Judea and Samaria and Gaza, that in fact, the Bedouins actually, along with the Druze, serve in the IDF. I mean, that they are, you know, considered fine in that regard. And that, and also that the Bedouins of the Negev, which is, by the way, the Hebrew word for desert, that they are no longer nomadic in a sense the way they were maybe 100 years ago, that they've settled down, that they've got communities and they've got villages for the most part. Is that, am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, generally, so it was, you know, the flare up over the tree planting campaign, you know, that they were able to stop. So as of now, it's been stopped. And there was, you know, some right wing Israeli agitation that was openly saying that they're going to use the tree planting as a precursor to,
I see,
to taking their land. So, I mean, there was reasonable fears that there were even people in the government coalition that were talking about, you know, this being the first step towards taking that land for, you know, Jewish only use. But, you know, like it did. So I mean, that was probably the biggest news story in Israel this week. Okay. And there was the Ram party that almost caused the breakout of the coalition. And so they withdrew the tree planting in the Negev that, you know, generally the Israelis, the Jewish Israelis kind of accepted that the tree planting was a precursor to a land grab. And, you know, so some sort of land grab from Bedouin regions of Israel that, you know, so there was elements in Israel that did actually openly say that they wanted to do a land grab from the Bedouins. And so at this point, it's been stopped. And so actually, the biggest news story in Israel this week from the Israeli perspective was, like, in the last, there were two military accidents. One happened last week. And, you know, I got forbidden to mention it, but last week, but there was a helicopter crash that I think two people died in. And then just yesterday, there was a friendly fire, you know, God forbid, like, I guess there was some sort of stolen equipment, and two different Israeli units were looking for it, and they came upon each other, and two people were killed in a friendly fire, actually from the exact same unit at night. That, you know, it's unclear exactly what happened, but they had some sort of stolen night vision equipment, and, you know, who knows who stole it, if it was, you know, Arabs or, you know, Israeli troops or whatever, but they were out looking for it, two separate units, and they came across each other and killed each other, God forbid. Two people died. So the two, and so within 1 week, there's been four Israeli deaths from military accidents. And, you know, that's probably, you know, bigger than the number of terrorism. Like, you know, there were a few terrorism acts the other day, but that like the last few weeks, but in terms of deaths, like, you know, this more from these military accidents. So there's even calls to, like, for people to resign or figure out what's going on. So that you know, like, might be a tell of you know, weakness in the coalition, and, you know, even a unit firing upon people in their own unit, God forbid. And then also last, I think it happened last week already, that the famous nation state bill that you know, got so much international condemnation, like, you know, Israel officially is an ethno state now, needed to be renewed, and it wasn't renewed. So last week, it you know, it was, I guess, a 1 year bill that has to be renewed every year, like the previous family unification thing that we talked about. So it wasn't renewed, and largely due to Likud, that the Ram party, the Arab party, didn't want to vote for it, and Likud, even though they support it, wanted to cause problems in the coalition, so they couldn't get a majority to renew it. And so I guess Minister Sheked, I guess a pretty popular minister, whatever, that she's in charge of the ministry that's enforcing it. So she was continuing to enforce this, basically breaking apart Jewish and Palestinian marriages, that the effect of this nation state law meant that if you're a Palestinian and you marry a Jew, that you can't get citizenship. So because it hasn't been renewed, now Palestinians that are married to Jews can receive Israeli citizenship. So she was using her ministership to prevent that, even though the law hadn't been renewed, and it reached the Supreme Court, and they ruled that she's not allowed to do that. So I mean, on a practical legal level, you know, the tens or maybe hundreds of Palestinians that might get Israeli citizenship, but you know, like, the, you know, it was a big deal when the name, I'm sure you talked, we talked about it.
Oh yeah, no,
they, I know they weren't able to renew this, you know, largely due to Likud wanting to the coalition to fail for another election. Prime Minister Netanyahu also might take some sort of plea bargain with his corruption trial that would still allow him to serve in politics. So that's unclear.
Right. And, although I don't see him coming back. I mean, I think that he did his, he served his time, but as far as the nationhood bill, I thought that, I don't know the details of that. My impression is that simply is a statement that Israel is a Jewish state, and that, you know, it is a state for the Jewish people. But I suppose there are some legal ramifications. You say that it prevents intermarriage between Israelis and Palestinians. And I mean, that's interesting. I thought
it prevents it. I mean, intermarriage between Israelis and Palestinians is largely already illegal, but because intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews is illegal, but it prevents by saying that if they're married against the law, you could still gain Israeli citizenship through marriage. So, right. There's a whole bunch of, complication. What is actually the Israeli law? How do things actually work? So if you're a Palestinian who actually married a Jew, you're eligible for Jewish citizenship, for Israeli citizenship. Yeah. So the nation's state law specifically, I think only Palestinians. So we talked about in the past, only Palestinians or there's some other countries are excluded from it. So one of the ramifications of it is if a Palestinian and Israeli get married in another country, and then generally Israel would accept it, even though the marriage would be illegal in Israel, and then the non-Jewish spouse would be able to obtain Israeli citizenship, except for Palestinians, based on the nation state law. And so now that the nation state law hasn't been renewed, so any Palestinians who had married Israelis and were eligible for citizenship, except for the nation state law, now can be eligible. And so she was holding it up, using her ministerial power to hold it up without the renewal of the law. So the Supreme Court said she can't do that. So I don't know how many. I mean, even if they never renewed the nation state law, I'm not sure how many hundreds or even thousands, the number of, so to say, illegal intermarriages mm-hmm. from Palestinians and Israelis, or if they got citizenship, it's more a minor issue relatively that, even a few hundred Palestinians get citizenship through intermarriage, but it's a sign of the current politics, and, the nation state law wasn't renewed.
Right, right. And my understanding is that there's a pretty active community of Israeli Jews married to Palestinian Arabs in Los Angeles, that a lot of them settled there. And that in Israel, there are a lot of strict regulations around marriage across the board, including Jewish marriage between, Reform and Orthodox, and between converts, whether they're recognized by the rabbinate. And which is why apparently people go to Cyprus. There's a huge industry in Cyprus of Israelis going to get married because they cannot get married in the state of Israel. But yet, I think if they're Israeli citizens, their marriages are recognized in Israel. Now, if you are married to if you're an Israeli who marries a Palestinian, and you're saying that under that law, the Palestinian partner cannot get citizenship.
There's no path to citizen.
Mean that they can't live in Israel? I mean, can they live there as like guests, or is it just that they're banned from living in Israel?
I'm not sure. So I mean, it's basically closing a loophole from the Israeli perspective there's a loophole as a path to citizenship to Israel through marriage, and it's closing that loophole to Palestinians that say, even if you find an Israeli woman to marry you, you still can't get into Israel.
Okay.
At this point, like if you're a Palestinian intermarried in Los Angeles and now want to apply for Israeli citizenship, maybe they could get Israeli citizenship now the nation state law is temporarily not been renewed. I mean, it may never be renewed. And so the number of actual cases of this is probably relatively
very small.
Even the security threat of it, it's is not saying that God forbid a Palestinian who married a Israeli is not too likely to be a terrorist or join Hamas or something like that.
And they might even convert to Judaism.
But I mean I was saying that there is the right wing view that they're saying like no, there should be absolutely no path to citizenship, period. Intermarriage shouldn't be recognized. And I said that currently Palestinians, I mentioned in the past, are barred from conversion, in terms of citizenship.
Yeah.
So that was the last point I wanted to mention in the news this week about conversion, because like in Israel, conversion to Judaism isn't necessarily a religious thing; it's a path to citizenship. And to close conversion to Palestinians isn't necessarily a religious thing. It's more closing that path to citizenship and or like to economic refugees or something, to fire conversions to African refugees or something. Just it's closing that path to citizenship, to, you know, to say that you know, economic migrants from Africa can't convert to Judaism. It's just saying like that path to citizenship is just not going to be available. So we'd mentioned that this minister of religious affairs, Kahana, due to this weird agreement with currently the coalition, who some sort of reform rabbi, not like an American style reform rabbi. So they had basically gotten rid of the minister of conversion. So the Rabbi Lau, in order to allow conversion or handle the current state of dispute, has basically said that he will personally oversee all conversion. So usually, I guess there was a minister appointed by the chief rabbi that oversaw conversion. And so the member of Knesset had the authority to sanction this minister, but Rabbi Lau, you know, technically, or at least according to the current state of the law, has, you know, personally, you know, will sign off on conversions. Let the government appointee of the chief rabbinate that had been doing it, even though that it's defunct, is now specifically in the hands of the chief rabbi. So the holdup is still there, and they're trying to pass legislation. And basically, because I said, like, you know, conversion to Judaism in Israel is within the rabbinate and a function of religion, but it's also a path to citizenship.
It's a political thing, exactly. And
it's, well, because it's a path to citizenship,
exactly.
Some extent should have nothing to do with religion. So they want to, right, basically, Kahana's trying to pass legislation, and it's funny because Mayor Kahana is such a famous Kahana.
It's not the same thing.
Because this guy's reform or somewhat anti-religious, and he wants to create a political body that will oversee conversions, and basically that the prime minister and a body of politicians will be able to make conversions to Judaism, and then the chief rabbinate would be able to object to it. But if there was like a, you know, this council of the Knesset that would be able to do conversions, would be able to overrule the rabbinate's objection, but would basically be saying that conversion to Judaism would become a political affair, not a religious affair. And it's somewhat logical, because it said that, right, the current state of, you know, to think in America, you're thinking about it as a religious thing, but in Israel, it's not such a religious thing. It's more
a question political of
path,
thing.
Because it's a path to citizenship, and saying, so we'll let the,
well, they don't want to have enemies of the
country, a body decide who can become a citizen,
yeah,
and not the rabbis. And so that's the current legislation that they're trying to propose. As I said, the first one was trying to just make it local, that the local rabbinate would be able to allow converts. That means like liberal areas of Israel that have a more lax rabbinate would be able to have lax conversion, and those, that would be a path to citizenship. And so that, you know, failed. And so now the new thing is to make a political body that a group of three Knesset, okay, members will be able to convert people to Judaism. And there's no way the rabbis will agree to it. It's unlikely to go forward. And saying that, you know, the minister Kahana said that there's 450,000 non-Jews, mostly, I don't know if it's that many Russian or total.
They're
talking about 450,000 non-Arab non-Jews in Israel. So that, you know, that you know, are really Israelis as Jews. It's a pretty substantial number.
Are they Russian? I mean, or are they like Spanish? Or who are they that they're not Arab and they're not Jewish?
But I mean, they're probably mostly Russian. There's Ethiopian. There might be like some.
Well, Indian. The Ethiopians are Jews. I mean, for the
they're actually not. I mean, the rabbinate ruled them not Jewish. They have to go through conversion.
No, I think that's.
We've discussed this before, saying they're Jewish for the right of return, but they were not Jewish according to the rabbinate
of Israel. But I think that's something that's still being debated, and it's up for dispute. It seems to me
it's not, because I mean, the chief rabbinate as but power.
We have there are a lot of Ethiopian Jews who are Israeli citizens, including a huge.
Yeah, but they're not considered Jewish according to the rabbinate, and the rabbinate ultimately controls the definition of Judaism. How do you have? Because you don't have to be Jewish according to the rabbinate to become the rabbinate doesn't decide.
They don't care about citizens.
For the right of return. But once
all right, you get so Israel, they don't. I think I know what you mean.
We've discussed this many times. Yeah, I'm saying like you just said, like if you know, like a patrilineal descent, there's all sorts of people who are eligible for the right of return that are considered. It's a two-tiered system that you're the right of return. You're Jewish, and you become an Israeli Jewish citizen, and you have an Israeli passport, not
all right.
Like a Christian
so
or
I
Arab.
Have- I have,
but once you get there, the rabbis, you further will detail it whether you're considered Jewish for mainly kosher marriage and burial. But you know, so he's saying there's 450,000 of them. You could look into it. It includes the Egyptians, and so basically that's what they're proposing now is that the Knesset, not the rabbis, would be able to create a committee that would be able to deem those people Jewish, not for the right of return, but
very
for
interesting.
Internal, Jewish law. So
an interesting question. It's very complex, rather labyrinthine. But anyway, Dovid, I've got my next guest here. Pastor Bill Jenkins is coming on with me.
So I'll sign off. Nice talking.
Same here. Where can people listen to your show?
I don't have anything coming up on my channel. I got Dovid. I have a lot of content and you know stuff like on like half Jews and the history of conversion and all sorts of issues like consciousness. Sunday nights on Church of Entropy. I do a week in review and or just next week here. So appreciate it. I'll try to tune in and catch your next guest. And I look forward to your regular program. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, David. Shabbat Shalom. All right. And Pastor Bill Jenkins will be joining us shortly. Pastor Bill Jenkins is the author of a new book, The Prophetic Almanac for 2022. He's connecting right now. And let me just see here. He has like a couple of interviews up. And basically, he talks about Pastor Jenkins. Thank you for joining me. Can you hear me okay? Let's wait to you. There we go. How's your audio? Are you there, sir? Nope. Maybe we're not. You need to turn up the audio. So Pastor Bill Jenkins is the author of The Prophetic Almanac for 2022. Pastor Jenkins, I think you need to turn on your audio so we can hear you. I can see you, but I can't hear you. Can you hear me okay? All right, I don't think somehow we're connected. Well, Pastor Jenkins, you're welcome to speak up. I hope that you can fix your audio problem, but I'm not hearing you right now. I don't know if you hear me. But as I mentioned, you are the author of The Prophetic Almanac for 2022. My sound is okay. You don't hear me. Well, there we go. I see a connection to the audio. This is it could be a little, there we go. Can you hear me now, Pastor?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Okay. So as I mentioned, you are the author of this new book, The Prophetic Almanac for 2022. How do you derive your prophecies and your speculations on upcoming events? I assume you derive it from the Old Testament. So talk about that.
Well, it could be from any part of the Bible. It's just looking at the number 22 and when it's mentioned in the Bible, and then when it's mentioned, what does it revolve around? That's the key.
Okay.
This was birthed out of something I had a desire to really know God more, and so the Lord showed me numbers in the Bible were important, and so the number 22 is obviously the number for this year, so that's what I look at to sort of get the vision for this coming year.
Now, it seems like you're involved in a tradition called numerology where and this is a Jewish tradition going into from the Zohar where there's like a mapping of biblical script to try to discern events as they unfold and to try to uncover spiritual elements of the Bible. Is there a tradition that you are deriving this from in terms of looking at this number?
Well, you know, what I do is I haven't invented the study of numbers. Other people did that for me, but I sort of like Chick-fil-A. You know, Chick-fil-A didn't invent the chicken sandwich. They just perfected it.
Yeah, so they made a better sandwich.
Sort of, you know, perfected some of the insights. And I look at numbers that most people don't. For instance, 22 is a hidden number of the Bible. And we wouldn't really call it numerology as much as we would studying it to see the consistency of that number when it's mentioned and then what it means when it's mentioned in order to develop a vision.
Okay. I mean, my dear friend, the late Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld told me, and I never really was able to confirm this, but he said that there were statisticians and religious figures who got together and they did a full numeric analysis of the Old Testament. And what they did in the process was prove that there was a God and that that the Torah has that in it. I mean, there's everything in the Torah, according to Jewish tradition, but specifically it proved God. Now you're saying that your usage of this technique of examining the number 22, because this is in the Christian calendar, the year 2022, codified by the by Pope Gregory, the Gregorian calendar. What do you see going on in terms of upcoming events?
Well, when I look at the number 22, I don't ever tell it what it says. It tells me what it wants to say. And so when I see the number 22 in the Bible, it really revolves around three main themes. And that is order, or getting your house in order, because we have a lot of disorganization in our world. There's a lot of chaos in the world. So this is sort of a year to get things in order in our life. It also revolves around marriage. And it revolves around the Holy Spirit. So those three things, when you see 22 in the Bible, are really what 22 means when it's mentioned. Now, it's only mentioned 9 times, but when it's mentioned, those are the three things: marriage, the Holy Spirit, and then order in our lives.
So we're talking here more about personal issues and not necessarily political or the bigger picture. You know, in a way, like this is a sociological concept that was developed by C. Wright Mills, the sociological imagination. You look at the personal, and then you look at that person in the context of the world that they're in, and you look at the history in the context of the present in order to understand present conditions and project into the future.
Yeah, and it could be any part of our lives. It could be political. It could be personal. It could be, you know, relational. It could be emotional or physical. It's every way and realm. It's just how it all pans out in the long run. Think about it. There's 31,102 verses in the Bible. Every verse is important. So if every verse is important, every word is important. If every word is important, then there's a reason why. There's names and colors and places and numbers that are mentioned, as well as symbols in the Bible that are mentioned, because they have a purpose, they have a reason, and they help us to dissect sort of the true meaning of what God is trying to get across to us, and it helps us to understand God even more.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Jewish tradition is that every single word of the Bible is divine, and it was given by God, and I think that tradition was continued by Jesus, who said that every single jot and tittle of the Bible shall be forever, and that the covenant shall be forever. So, you know, now that we've established that, can you talk a little bit about this year and what we might see in terms of personal relationships, marriages, and whatnot?
Well, I feel like the number 22 is that number that helps us to build on our marriages. You know, the Bible actually mentions marriage 22 times, and in Genesis 2:22, the Bible talks about how God brought the woman from the side of the rib of the man. And so we see the divorce rate going up in the world. We see it going up in the church. So no matter whether you're going to church or not, the divorce rate is sort of increasing. So what we want to do is focus in on our marriages. What works? What doesn't work? What can we do to improve? What can we do to be a better spouse? This ought to be a year when we focus in on those relationships. Our relationship with our spouse ought to be the number one earthly relationship that we focus in on. And I have a principle, whatever you feed will grow, whatever you starve will die. So if you feed yourself, on wanting to make your marriage better, if you seek to outserve your spouse, you're going to be able to make your marriage better. And then the Holy Spirit, the Bible said in John 20:22 that Jesus, he breathed on his disciples and he said, "Receive ye the Holy Ghost." Now you remember in Genesis, Adam was alive, but he wasn't living until God breathed in his nostrils. And so I think we need a breath of fresh air in 2022. There's so much that has been going on. There's so many things that are happening that are sort of discouraging. We need to hit that reset button, if you will. And we need to really allow the Holy Spirit to lead, guide, and direct us in every one of our ways. And then order is something that I think we have to have, because we're sort of experiencing disorder, physical disorders, mental disorders, marital disorder, civil disorder, political disorder. Every way in every realm, there's disorder. Nobody can disagree with that. So this is going to be a year when we get things in order. The Bible tells us that even Abraham, he got his affairs in order so that his children, when Abraham died, would not have, a bunch of arguing and fighting. We know Hezekiah was told by the prophet. He said, "Get your house in order. You're about to die." And when he got his house in order, when he did what he needed to do, he got a 15-year extension on his life. And so getting our houses in order, getting our hearts in order are very important. So those three things are really something that we need to emphasize this year. If we're going to be successful, we got to let it start at home. We got to let it start in our heart, and we got to allow the power of the Holy Spirit to truly transform our lives.
You know, I think that's a really, really great message, you know, especially in these times when we've had social unrest, we've had lockdowns, we have to walk around with a piece of cloth on our face, there's health problems, children can't go to school, and you know, there's mental issues, and there's suicide and drug abuse and all sorts of stuff that's on the uptick, and depression. You know, that in order to get our house in order, starting with ourselves and getting our own health in order, you know, learning how to improve our physical existence, then yes, get our marriages in order. You know, I mean, spend time checking in with your spouse and you know, finding out what's good and bad and what's going on, and just, really paying attention and waking up to that. I don't know if divorce is on the increase this year, but all in all, it has been on the increase. However, even in the, and I think there's been an assault on marriage that's been underway since really the 1960s, with the free love movement and all these other things. I still think that the marriage, though, between a man and a woman is such an organic entity, and it's so intrinsic and it's so natural to the human experience, and it's so real that it has withstood this. You know, I mean, it's withstood an open assault on the part of the establishment to try to dismember it and dismantle it. It hasn't worked. It's still there. There is some power between that relationship between a man and a woman. It's the most difficult and most complicated relationship in existence. And yet, right? And I'm speaking here as a member of the club, by the way. but at the same time, there's nothing greater. I mean, there's nothing more fulfilling and more powerful than that relationship. It's really a reenactment of Adam and Eve. And you know, it's in every sense, including, you know, consummation. I mean, it's and I think that we need to take stock of that. And it's also from a general sense, the marriage unit is very sovereign. It's very solid. It is a partnership in every sense, business wise and in otherwise, and that it's an equal partnership ultimately. And that's why I think there's an agenda to tear it down, because you have collectivists who want to create a world order, and marriage is one of those institutions that stands in the way.
Yeah, and if you think about it, God only gave us three institutions. So we have government, We have the church, and then we have marriage. What was the first institution God created? It was marriage.
Yeah.
So anything that was created first is obviously something that must be pretty important. And so marriage is the first institution that God created, and he created it for men and women to live together in holy matrimony, and he created it to be sort of the launching pad for us to establish families. You mentioned it a minute ago, there's an attack on marriage. There's an attack on families.
Yeah.
And so we see that almost every day. And, you know, I feel like we got to get back to some good foundation when it comes to our marriage relationships, to our families. Let's do this in 2022. If our marriages, if our families are going to be successful, then we're going to have to invest time. I'm a family guy. I've been married 23 years. I got three boys. There's nothing more important to me on this earth than my family. Mm-hmm. I have to show that by spending time. My kids spell love, T-I-M-E. So if I don't spend time with them, they don't think I love them. So I have to spend time with them. Even as they're getting older, that time is valuable. That time is important. And so marriage has got to be a great emphasis that we place, that we put. Nobody's going to make our marriages better but us. Nobody's going to care more than we are. So we have to invest that time, invest that energy, do what we need to do. One of the keys, in my opinion, is seeking to outserve your spouse. If you can seek to outserve your spouse, if you can speak their love language, if you can be, you know, maybe a little bit more kind, a little bit more loving, it's going to go a long way in improving your marriages here in 2020.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like an investment. And you know, I'm also a father, and I've always said that, you know, I make it my business. I make it a point, and I say this to other fathers and mothers, that you have to spend at least, if it's only 10 or 15 minutes, every day you have to spend some time alone with each of your children. And it has to be just you and them.
Yeah.
Even if they're not talking to you, you know, even if they're angry at you, just be there and listen to whatever is going on. And, you know, you have to try to do that every day. It makes a huge difference. And same thing with the spouse. You know, if you show some affection and some kindness and some time, it pays off in the long run, even if you're not getting along. You know, it just, it's like an investment.
Yeah, and that's the key, is understanding that it is an investment and making that time. You know, when my kids were younger, it was a lot easier for me to spend time with them because I could coach their teams.
Yeah,
you know, right. So if they play baseball, basketball, football, I just coach their team. So I spend time with them. As they get older, you know, I got two of them in college. They're involved in different activities. They have this, that, and the other. And so we have to be what I call, we have to be intentional about our time. We have to be intentional about, you know, making sure that we're spending that time. And, you know, if I'm the dad, I have to make sure that I'm the most intentional about making that time happen. And so I think that's what our mindsets have to be. We have to be intentional about spending time, feeding those good things, like our relationship with our spouse, like with our kids, in order for it to be better. If you ignore it, it's not going to get better. You have to invest the time. It's an investment, just like anything else. And if you'll put it in, you'll receive and reap a good harvest later on for the effort you're putting forth today.
That's right. And I mean, obviously, the relationship changes once the child is flown the coop, so to speak, and they're in college or they're out in the world. And so, yeah, at that point, it may not be every day, but you have to continue to keep in mind that you need to make a connection every so often. I mean, and somewhat regularly if possible, even as an adult. I mean, the relationship then becomes, you know, you're more equals, you're both adults, there's a different dynamic. And it's an exciting dynamic, you know, when your child is an adult. I mean, there's every stage of the development is amazing. I personally think it gets better and better and better as you go on. At least, you know, for me, it has in my case. But, you know, you have to, you know, just you have to accept that it's changed and that then they have their own families and that, you know, you need to understand your role at that point.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, is understanding, you know, what your place is, where you fit in. You know, the Bible tells us that we're one body, but many members. You know, I don't walk on my hands. You know, and I don't eat with my feet. There's a reason for certain body parts that we have, there's certain usages for those. And so right. we have to sort of figure that out. That's important for us to get, you know, our marriages and our families in order. And I think that's the key for 2022. When you think about getting things in order, you have to think about getting things organized. Too many people are disorganized. That's mm-hmm. why there's chaos politically. That's why there's chaos civilly. That's why we have so many things going on in our world that we shouldn't have, because we're disorganized. We're disjointed. We're not working together. We're not walking in unity. And if we can learn to do that, I think we can change that paradigm. I'm a man of hope. I believe in hope. So I believe that things can change, but we got to put in that effort. They're not going to change on their own. We have to put in that effort to make it happen.
Indeed. And so Pastor Bill Jenkins, just to give us a little bit more of a thumbnail in terms of what someone is going to find in your book.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things. You know, I love to do this book, but if you've heard of the Farmer's Almanac, then you're going to love this, because this is sort of the spiritual equivalent. So I give you a preview in the book where I tell you different things to watch, people to watch, dates to watch. I give you like the sport of the year based upon the number 22. For instance, the NFL and soccer both have 22 players on the field at the same time. I give you different scriptures. I tell you what it means to be born on the 22nd day of the year. I will also break down every book of the Bible that has a chapter 22. Now, in the King James Version Bible, we have 66 books. 22 of those books have a 22nd chapter. Mm-hmm. And so we'll look at each of those chapters that have each book of the Bible that has a chapter 22, and we'll break it down and we'll tell you, this is what it means. For instance, Genesis 22. Great story about Abraham and Isaac. You know how Abraham, was asked to sacrifice his son. And a key scripture there in Genesis 22 is where the Bible says that Abraham put the wood in order. Think about that. When he was asked by God to sacrifice his son, he didn't just go through the motions. He didn't just do it to do it. He did it in order. He did it perfectly. He placed the wood perfect. So that's an example to us of how each book of the Bible that has a chapter 22 in it sort of confirms that this is a year of marriage, this is a year of order, and this is a year of the Holy Spirit. So it's really cool to see the connection that you see with the chapter 22s, with 22, and it's mentioned in the Bible. And so there's so many great things in this book. It's 120 pages filled with inspiration, information, divine revelation. I want to teach you how to develop a plan for your life, how to have a purpose for your life, because the Bible says that without a vision, the people perish. So I'm here to give you a vision in this book based upon what the number 22 means when it's mentioned in the Bible. But this is a fun book. I'll talk about entertainment. I'll talk about history. Most people don't even know who the 22nd president is, but there's a connection between the 22nd president and today. It's really cool. This book is sort of an eye opener, and it will talk about so many things that I think can help you. We'll also give a spiritual forecast. I'll break down 50 states in the 5 regions, give one word for America that I think we all need in this day in order for us to be set up for success here in 2022.
Well, I mean, if anything else, it's a great way to study biblical scripture. It's a great way to put your house in order. Who was the 22nd president?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that because I saw your eyes go up, you know. And so when we talk about in the book, I tell you who the 22nd president is. It was Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland.
Interesting.
And he was the first Democrat elected after the Civil War in 1885.
Great man.
And so he was the only president to leave the White House and return for a second term 4 years later. So
that's prophetic, because that could happen with
right?
Trump.
And so you can see a lot of crazy connections. You know,
yes.
The 22nd Amendment was passed in 1947, limiting presidents to 2 4-year terms, but they don't necessarily have to be consecutive
four-year
terms.
So in a way, we're here now possibly looking at a re-election for President Trump. Some people might even say it will be his third term, but we'll put that aside. But yes, this is interesting. It's fun and it's positive, and it has a spiritual and moral side to it, which I appreciate. Bill, where can people get your excellent book?
Well, they can go to Amazon. They can download it on ebook Kindle. They can go to eBay. We recently found out that Walmart just picked up our books. And so we're excited about that.
That's huge.
You know, the largest retailer in America just picked up our books. And so you can get it at Walmart. You can go to Barnes & Noble. Probably the best place to go is still PastorBillJenkins.org, because there you can get all my books. I've written 16 books. And you can also listen to all the programs we have for our radio program. And you can connect with me on social media like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube to get my Minute That Matters. It's a 1 minute, 60-second video devotional every single day, Monday through Friday.
Oh, great.
People love it. It goes around the world. Radio stations play it just as a 1 minute little devotion. And so if you go to PastorBillJenkins.org, it's your one-stop shop. If anything you want to know, anything you want to find out about our ministry, it's all available there at PastorBillJenkins.org.
Well, listen, Pastor Jenkins, I want to thank you for joining me. It's an interesting concept. It's an interesting book, and you present it very well. Let's stay in touch, and let's do some programming from time to time.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, man. Always love being with you, brother.
All right. Thanks a lot, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. God bless.
Thank you.